entire summers, a little over 3 years, and I have managed to avoid this topic for 3 years and 3 months. It's not been intentional. It's not something that I've tried to avoid preaching on. On the other hand, it's not been something I've necessarily felt like I needed to preach on. This is a pressing issue, and it's a relatively pertinent issue across state lines, across demographic groups and such. But let's just put it this way. If I can get out of preaching this, I'm going to get out of preaching this. It's not my favorite thing to preach about. But it is necessary. It is in the Bible, and I will preach on it eventually, and I figure I've put it off long enough. So if you haven't already turned to 1 Timothy chapter 2, there are other modesty texts, and we'll be touching on a couple of them mainly, but we'll be focusing primarily here as I'll give you what I'm calling the modesty sermon. And as you're turning to that opening, I will emphasize that if you have studied this topic 100 times in your life, if you've heard 2 dozen sermons on this topic in your life, that doesn't necessarily mean that you've heard the truth. That doesn't necessarily mean that you've understood it properly. It doesn't necessarily mean that you remember all these things. And so it's important for us to review these things, to find out properly what we are talking about, because these are Bible things, and we need to have a proper understanding of these things, especially if we are claiming that these things are the things of God. We need to make sure that we are speaking where the Bible speaks and being silent where the Bible is silent. We need to make sure that we're defining our terms properly. And so what I want to spend a fair amount of time doing here this evening is defining our terms, talking about what we're actually dealing with in the context of 1 Timothy chapter 2 and in the context of the Bible at large when we're talking about the topic of modesty. Now what I did was I went back and tried to define this term, modesty. And the first thing that I did was I looked up in the dictionary. And according to dictionary.com, these are the top two definitions for modest. Number one is having or showing a moderate or humble estimate of one's merits, importance, etc., free from vanity, egotism, boastfulness, or great pretensions. The second definition is closely associated with that, free from ostentation or show extravagance. Now, that shouldn't necessarily surprise anybody here. I think that if we use the word modest or modesty in our everyday conversations, this is the kind of thing that we're talking about. This is what we mean when we talk about modest. We have this big picture of Donald Trump in our head, and think that's what we're trying to strive for here. That's a picture of modesty, right? Somebody who is not going to be flashy, somebody who is not going to draw unnecessary attention to himself or to herself. That's what the dictionary says anywhere, the primary meanings of this word. Now, you and I know that words appear in our Bibles that are not necessarily defined properly by dictionary.com or other kind of dictionaries that you might want to run into. Sometimes the rendering that we have, our version that we're reading from is archaic, or for whatever reason, the word that we see in the text is not immediately identifiable as the word that we use in our everyday terminology, even though it's spelled the same and pronounced the same. So we'll go a little bit deeper than this, and we'll look into the Greek language and decide what the word modest here means in the Greek. And I'll use my usual disclaimers here. You're not looking at a Greek scholar here by any means, but I can read a Greek dictionary with the best of them and read English, which is the language that my Greek dictionary is written in, and come up with a pretty good estimation of what the scholars say this word originally meant. If you look at Vine, Mr. Vine, and he's one of the classic Greek logicians, lexicographers is the word I was looking for, sorry about that. The word eidos, which is usually used with reference to the word modest here, eidos he defines as being a sense of shame, which kind of goes along with what we're talking about, wasn't it? Shamefastness is the word that appears in the Old King James Version, which is the version that Vine uses primarily for his dictionary, and it appears in this text in the Old King James Version, if I remember right. He says, shamefastness is that modesty which is fast or rooted in the character. And this is one of the situations where a couple hundred years of linguistic evolution has changed things a little bit. We don't usually use the word fast in this context, unless we're talking about laundry. If we're talking about laundry and you're talking about color fast, something that's going to hold on to the to the color. Well, here this shamefastness, the idea is that this sense of shame, the sense of right and wrong, the sense of just basic decency, how people are supposed to be portrayed, is fast in the character of this person. The shame itself is not fast in the person. That's an important distinction to make there. It's that sense of shame, that sense of right and wrong, as it were. This is the way that I'm supposed to present myself. This is the way that I want to not present myself. That sense, which is rooted in Bible character, which is rooted in Bible definitions, Bible concepts, this is fast in our character. We don't wake up one day and decide whether we're going to be shamefaced. That's not the way it works. It's just who you are, and hopefully who we can remain. In the context of 1 Timothy chapter 2, you'll find that that fits actually very well in what we are looking at here. Because overall, in this context, we're not just talking about clothing. In fact, we're not even primarily talking about clothing. We're talking about character. We're talking about who a person is, and more specifically, who a woman is. And I'll back up here for a second and admit something that you've probably picked up on already, and that is that we're going to be talking primarily to the women today. And you know, I'd apologize for that, but that's the way the text is written. And we can preach at the men some other time here. And I'm not saying that these principles don't have validity with regard to men, but this is primarily a woman kind of topic. Men, certainly, please feel free to derive any kind of application that you may find appropriate. But here, primarily, we're talking about what women are doing or what women are not supposed to be doing. We find in verse number 11, for instance, in this context, or verse number, we'll back up in verse number 9. He says, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modestly and discreetly, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly garments. I have verse 11 there. Clearly, that's verse number 9. I apologize for that. But rather, he says, by means of good works, as is proper for women making a claim to godliness. A woman must quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness. This is talking about the way a woman behaves in society in general, and especially in the church society. How she's supposed to present herself. And in this context, this notion of modest or modesty is a tool in the arsenal of the woman, as it were, to distance herself from the way that other women present themselves. Other women do not have this shamefast character. They just have the shame. They left off the fastness, as it were. And this is demonstrated in various ways. The braiding of the hair, the gold, the pearls, costly garments, etc. But rather by means of good works. And you'll notice there, my not but phrase. That's popping up there. It's been a while since I've talked about not but phrases, so we'll see it here again. When you see the not and the but put together, this is a very common figure of speech, which is intended to diminish the importance of the first element for the purpose of emphasizing the second element. And that's what we're saying here. The thing about braided hair and gold and pearls and costly garments is not that they're so horrible in and of themselves. They may or may not be. You'd have to turn to some other context to determine that. What we're saying here is that these are supposed to be lessened in their significance so we can emphasize something else. And in this context, emphasizing the good works. What's going on here, apparently, at least what Paul is conceptualizing, is that there are women in the church who are so caught up in physical accoutrements and the way that they present themselves to the world that it keeps them from being modest. It keeps them from having this sense of propriety. What they ought to be doing is showing themselves to be people of good works, women of good works. And they're so busy with the other, it's interfering with this. Now, the way that gold and pearls and costly garments, that kind of makes sense. I think that we can understand how that might work. You might be kind of fuzzy on the braided hair thing. I was fuzzy on the braided hair thing too, and I have been for a long time. I'm not sure I'd ever actually done any research on this until preparing for this lesson. And I went and did some research and found some interesting kind of things. The braiding of hair in this culture was not the same as the braiding of hair in our culture. In our culture, you know, you want to get your hair, ladies, you have long hair, you want to get it out of your face, you want to get it out of whatever, I don't understand women's hairstyles, I'm not trying to act like I do, but they braid it together so it'll get out of the way and maybe look moderately attractive, and that's it. That's not the kind of braiding we're talking about here.
Oftentimes in the first century, hair was braided by the women specifically so that they could use these very elaborate bejeweled combs and decorations. Basically, the braids were intended to give the woman another opportunity to show off how rich she was. It wasn't always done this way, but that's in the context here. That they had these, and of course the archaeologists and such have found some of these very elaborate tortoiseshell type combs with jewels all in them, and you know, thousands and thousands of dollars worth of jewelry put in a hair comb so that the woman wear in the back of her head. It's not enough to have all this fancy stuff in the front, you got to have the fancy stuff in the back too. That is a way that these women were trying to show themselves off to society. And it's exactly the opposite of what Paul says women are supposed to be doing. Women are supposed to be demonstrating their good works, their good deeds, their character. And to do that, instead of the others, would require a sense of modesty. Now, the way that this... we don't do the same thing with the braiding hair these days, obviously. We understand that culture is going to change somewhat. The way that you demonstrate a shamefast attitude, the way that you demonstrate a modest attitude, is going to change to a certain degree from culture to culture and from time to time. That's just the way it works. It has to be that way. We're not saying that everybody has to wear we have to wear the same clothes that people wore in the first century. People in the first century didn't wear the same clothes as people wore in the first century. Depending on where you lived and what culture you're coming from, they wore all kinds of different things. What doesn't change, and we may talk a little bit more specifically about that, but what doesn't change from culture to culture and from time to time is this attitude that the women are supposed to have, and the men too. What we're supposed to make sure that we do is demonstrate ourselves with our character. And if we have some kind of habit, some kind of show or demonstration that's interfering with that, that's making us the fancy person or the rich person or the person who thinks that they're so much better than me, if that's the kind of attitude that we're putting out, then we need to change our habits. We need to change our clothes. We need to change whatever so that we can be this modest kind of person that the text is talking about. So that's the word modest. Now, there's another word that's used in this context also, and that's in the New American Standard Bible rendered the word proper. We'll back up here and read this again. In verse number 9, likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing. That's the way that New American Standard reads in verse number 9. You may have a little bit different word, but this is a different word. This word is the word cosmos. And if that looks like the word cosmos in English, then give yourself a brownie point, because that's where our word cosmos comes from. And the it's wonderful that we use that word in that way, because the astronomers tell us that we can project 1,000 years from now where the constellation Virgo or where Sagittarius or where Venus or where Mercury or whatever, exactly where it's going to appear in the night sky at any particular moment from any square foot of territory in the world. 1,000 years from now, we can know exactly what the sky is going to look like, assuming that there are no clouds, of course. That's because there is an order built into the universe that in and of itself testifies to one who created the order. And there's a huge lesson in the power of God and the majesty of God and such in that we're not going to preach today. But that's the word cosmos, cosmos. It means orderly, it means well-arranged, it means decent. Everything in its place, everything being done properly. And it's the same word that's used in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2 with regard to the description of elders. Elders in the New American Standard Bible are said to be respectable. They're supposed to be respectable anyway. It's the same word, cosmos. And the idea being that the elder does what he's supposed to do. He's not full of surprises. He's not just going to decide just for no particular reason. Everything's black is going to be white and white's going to be black. Everything is ordered. Very similar to the concept in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, I think it's verse 31, where it says everything that we do in the church is supposed to be done decently and in order in the Old King James Version. Same concept here. I'll admit I didn't run the Greek references on that. I'm not quite sure if it's the same word, but same concept. that everything is to be done properly. Everything's to be done in its place. Well, how does that fit in with 1 Timothy chapter 2? Again, we're talking about not just what a woman wears, but who a woman is, how she presents herself, how she demonstrates herself, who she is, in fact. The text here in 1 Timothy chapter 2 talks a lot about a woman's role in the church and in the home. And this propriety is primary. And we get specific about this. And I know there's a lot of debate over some of these things that we're... I'm going to dodge a couple of landmines here. Sorry to ruin your fun if you think I'm going to get here and talk a whole lot about some of these things. I'm not. But we will talk about some of them a little bit. Verse number 11 talks about how a woman must quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness. This is her role with regard to teaching in the Lord's church and I would argue also in the family. That she is not to be in an administrative role. She's not to be in a leadership kind of role. She is the support player. She is receiving the support, the instruction that's being given by the men in the church, by the men in her family. A little bit more why that's the case is explained as we go along. Verse number 13, for it was Adam who was first created, and then Eve. Again, take this up with the Lord, if you want to. But the Lord tells us not only was Adam made first, and then Eve, as the text says here, as Genesis chapter 2 says, but also that it was done that way on purpose. And there is a distinction made between men's roles and women's roles in chapter 3. But my impression of this text and my impression of Genesis chapter 2 and maybe some other passages as well indicates that the male-female roles, to a certain extent, exist even before the fall. That woman was created specifically to be a helper for man. That doesn't mean that a woman is less important or less significant or less a human or whatever, but that is her role, to support the man in his efforts to run the family, to run the church, as it were. This is the woman's role, to be the support, because she came second. Eve's transgression, of course, magnifies that idea. Eve's transgression, of course, was Eve not staying within that role, deciding that she wanted to do something a little different. Notice in verse number 15, but women will be preserved for the bearing of children if they continue in faith and love and sanctity with self-restraint. Now, I know that this passage does not mean that as long as you birth enough babies, ladies, you're going to be okay. That can't be what it's saying here. Not just because it doesn't make any sense, not just because they don't like it, but because the Bible teaches otherwise. And if we're going to accept the Bible as a whole, we have to believe that there's some kind of figure of speech going on here, some kind of accommodative language. I think what we're seeing here is this bearing of children stands as a representation of the woman's role in the family and in culture. There are certain things that a man can't do. The most obvious one is birthing babies. And I'm okay with that, to be perfectly honest with you. I just assume it stay that way. That's the way that things are set up. That's the order, as it were, for the way that things are supposed to be going. Now, if the woman is properly serving in the role that she has been given by God, if she is being a good woman in her society, if she's being a good woman in her family, being a good woman in the church, that's how she's going to demonstrate her greatness. That's how she's going to demonstrate her worth. Not in being the most manly woman that ever came, the greatest leader that women ever had, or anything like that, but rather being a woman and doing the best that she possibly can at that. Now, there may be more to that text than that. I wouldn't doubt it. I think that gets at the crux of it, though. And if you have more information about how that works, then by all means, let me know about it, and you can preach on this next week. But this is I think that essentially ties up what we're talking about here. That is the proper role of a woman. And again, the clothing that the woman wears is supposed to emphasize that, the propriety. And so, in a nutshell, what are we talking about here? What is, then, proper clothing for a woman? Well, several things that we've talked about. First of all, proper clothing is that which does not attempt to show superiority of status. This is not your opportunity to show off. This is not your opportunity to prove that you're better than some other person, that you're better than another woman, that you're better than all the other women, that you're better than the men. That's not what your clothing is for. Your clothing is to work in cooperation with your character and to demonstrate your character, not to essentially testify to the lack of your character. Secondly, that which does not detract from her role as a woman or a wife. The clothing that you choose emphasizes your role. Now, we talked about culture before. The cultural role of clothes has changed over the years. You can like that, you can not like that, whatever. I have known of Christians in the past who took this to an extreme, I guess I would say, who would say basically that a woman is not to wear pants at all. That pants are man's clothing, and by wearing pants, she's assuming the role of a man, and so therefore she's in violation of 1 Timothy chapter 2, simply because she wore pants. Those of you ladies who are wearing pants right now, you'll be glad to hear that I disagree with that. I don't think that's true. In fact, I'm quite confident that it's not true. It's not very difficult to prove, actually. If you go back to Bible times, if you look at the men, for instance, in Isaiah's day or Moses' day or whatever, the Israelite garb for a man typically were these long flowing robes. This is very well established. It was what they wore in this day. They didn't wear pants. And in fact, it looked a lot more like a dress, to be perfectly honest, than it looked like pants. And if a young man were to present himself in the family wearing a pair of pants, their parents probably would have been upset about that. That's not proper clothing. Where in the world did you get that thing? You got that at the Gap or whatever? You know, you go put on a dress like you're supposed to be wearing, like your dad wears. That's the right thing to do. The proper clothing at that time was what it was. And over the years, as culture has changed, as times have changed, as fabrics have changed, the cultural demonstrations have changed also. Now, I think you can make a fairly decent argument that 150 years ago, or maybe even 100 years ago, in our American culture, that a woman would be exceeding her proper role in society by wearing pants. I think you might be able to make that argument. I'm not living 150 years ago, so I'm not in a position to say. I'm living right now. And anybody who's paying attention at all to the way the world is, to the way the world dresses, realizes that you talk to 1,000 people out there on the street, and you're going to get 1,000 people who tell you they don't care if a woman wears pants. That, just because a culture says it's okay, doesn't mean it's okay. Understand? And certainly there are some cultures where a woman is not properly clothed at all for decency reasons. But just because she's wearing clothing that in generations past were associated with men, that doesn't mean she's stopping being a woman in this context. She can still be a woman and wear modern clothing as long as it's proper clothing, as long as it's appropriate clothing. Perhaps most importantly, this clothing is supposed to be that which displays godliness as her most prominent trait. A similar discussion is found in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 2, where this woman who is married to a man who is not a Christian, she converts him without a word, the text says, by showing the word at work in her life as he observes her chaste and respectful behavior. That's the same kind of decency, the same kind of propriety that we're looking at here. By being a proper woman in this context, in all facets of her character, including the clothing that she chooses, she displays godliness as the most important thing in her life. And that's not necessarily, in fact, I would go so far as to say that's not what our culture does. I think you can make the case for men too, but especially for the women. You don't choose clothing so as to demonstrate how godly you are. You choose it for other reasons. And for those of you who are wondering if we were ever going to get around to cleavage and hemlines, here we are. I oppose clothing that shows too much of a woman's body, but not because of this concept of modesty. There are other reasons that we could talk about. And if you wanted me to preach a lewdness sermon or a lust sermon or whatever next week or the week after that, then I can start working on that. But the modesty concept here is telling a woman that she needs to show with everything she does, including her clothing, that she is God's person, that she's a godly woman. And that is what she is the most proud of. And I don't want to get vulgar about this, and I certainly am not going to put any pictures up here on the slides. But we are aware that there are women in our culture who are very proud of various aspects of their physical bodies And they demonstrate that. And they will brag about that, quite frankly, and do the selfie thing and all that stuff. That is the opposite of what we're looking at here. We're looking at a woman who is proud of her character. And that's what she wants to put on display. She's not going to show off her money. She's not going to show off her body. She's not going to show off any of these things so far as they would interfere with her ability to show off her godliness. And again, the specifics of how this exactly works is going to vary from culture to culture, from time to time. We talked about women wearing pants. If my family were going to Iran next week, and we're not, we're not going to go to Iran anytime soon, and not for this reason, for other reasons. But if we were to go, if I were to take my ladies into that kind of environment, I would force them, if necessary, to wear appropriate clothing for that situation. Not because I think that what they're wearing now is inappropriate. I don't think it is. But it would be inappropriate in that setting. That's not what women wear there. Well, you wear what women wear there. Just like, you know, there are all kinds of appropriate or inappropriate kind of things that men might wear as well. We want to be demonstrating our godliness more than anything else. And if we're putting on a big show with how weird we are, or how rebellious we are, or how trendy we are, or whatever, and that's how we're identified, that's going to wind up doing more harm to the cause of Christ than it is good. And that's the opposite of what we're trying to do. Now, a little bit about the opposite of this. What is not proper clothing? Well, there's a phrase that's used in Proverbs chapter 7, verse 10, for instance, in the context of a woman who is intentionally trying to entice a young man into a sinful relationship. And the New American Standard Bible calls her dressed as a harlot. And it's not too difficult, and I'm, again, not going to put the pictures up here, but you know what I'm talking about. You know what Solomon's talking about. There are ways that a woman can present herself that is specifically designed to create certain lustful impulses in the heart and mind of a man, especially a young man, but not just a young man. That's what being dressed as a harlot is. And maybe you have particular names of celebrities or whatever that are popping in your head right now. We're not going to go down that road. The point is, men have lustful impulses. And sometimes women decide they're going to demonstrate their power over men by playing on those impulses, by using what God gave them, as it were, or the plastic surgeon gave them, whatever, and going to use that to pull a man into a sinful situation. And that is the opposite of what we're supposed to be doing with our clothing. Improper clothing also that everybody is wearing is still inappropriate. If it's not in accordance with God's will and nobody's wearing it versus it's not in accordance with God's will and everybody's wearing it, it really doesn't make any difference. And this is the bikini argument that I usually will pull out here. Just because this is what people wear doesn't mean it's okay. Do we do that with any other aspect of our life in the sinful world? Well, people in this culture lie. People in this culture cheat on their taxes. People in this culture get drunk all the time. That's just what they do. And so I guess that's what I'm going to do. Well, hopefully we don't think that way. Well, why would we think that way about clothing? 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 16, Ephesians 5 verse 11, I'm aware those are not clothing passages. But nevertheless, the idea of coming out from among them and being separate, not touching the unclean thing, that's what we are supposed to be doing as people of God in a sinful world, exposing the works of darkness instead of participating in them, as Paul says in Ephesians chapter 5. This inappropriate stuff that appears to be popular for everybody else doesn't become okay because it's popular. We're going to take our cues from God and not from society. And thirdly, I'd suggest to you that which is so garish, so eye-catching, so, you might say, ugly, as to be an extreme distraction, especially in the assembly. Everything's supposed to be done for the mutual edification. Everything is to be done decently and in order. Again, not clothing passages. In 1 Corinthians 14, verses 26 and 40. But we have an obligation to our brothers and sisters in Christ. And as such, we want to make sure that we are presenting ourselves in a godly way that is going to emphasize godly aspects of our character and put people on the road to godliness rather than on the road to ungodliness, as it were. And so, therefore, if somebody comes in from the street, you're wearing a 3-foot mohawk or wearing, you know, some other kind of weird outfit, mixing Checks and plaids or, you know, whatever it happens to be, I'm not going to say anything to that. At least I probably won't. Unless I can't see over his head or something like that. Generally speaking, I'm going to let that go. We as Christians hopefully know better than that. Not that it's sinful to have a certain lifestyle, or a certain hairstyle or whatever, but that we need to be putting more important things at a higher priority than these simple personal demonstrations of ourselves. If I am behaving in such a way in the Lord's church as to cause somebody else to have a harder time, I'm pushing them further away from God instead of drawing them closer to God. That's not a behavior of love. That's not how a proper brother in Christ is going to behave, and so I'm not going to behave that way. I'm going to try to bring that person closer to me and closer to the Lord. It's a lot more important than me, you know, wearing my favorite ugly sweater or wearing my pants inside out or anything, you know, crazy like that. Don't laugh like it hadn't been done, folks. You've probably seen it done. Anyway, that is the modesty sermon. And I encourage you, as always, to examine what I've had to say about this subject, to continue to research it and come to your own conclusions about this. Make application in your life as is appropriate, men and women alike. Because the idea of being a modest person is not gender specific. We all need to be respectful and courteous toward one another and put other people's feelings, other people's needs ahead of our own. That is the very essence of serving in the body of Christ and putting Jesus' needs and Jesus' wants, of course, before everything. We're going to offer you an opportunity to respond to the Lord's invitation and make your life right with God in whatever may be necessary here. If there is something in which you have fallen astray, if there is some kind of a failing, a personal failing, a personal weakness or whatever that we can help you with and help you deal with it, perhaps even hear a confession of public sin and pray for you that you be forgiven. If you haven't ever been baptized in water for remission of sins and you're ready to do that, whatever we can do to help you walk with Christ more perfectly, please respond to the invitation while we stand and sing at this time.